Thank you very much for inviting me to this important occasion. The subject I've been asked to talk about is universities and economic growth. But let me just sort of raise the sort of basic proposition as to, you know, why we would want to take that as a subject. I mean, a lot of people in universities would sort of question it as being sort of inherently rather profane and rather contradicting the basic mission of universities, which is about learning and human improvement in the widest sense. And I was struck by the fact that the Vice Chancellor of the University of Warwick is introducing this, because there's somebody who remembers the mid-1960s, when I was a student, there was an occasion when the University of Warwick was one of the first batch of universities launched at that time. And the proposal was made by its first Vice Chancellor that they establish a business school. And this would be regarded these days as pretty uncontroversial and indeed a generally welcome thing to do. But I think at the time it was regarded as an appalling breach of faith with the basic mission of universities. Students rioted and tried to prevent this institution being established. And the whole idea that there was some connection between universities and the world of mammon was profoundly rejected. Well, I think we've moved an awful long way in the, well, almost 50 years since then. But I think it's worth stressing that, of course, there is this tension in universities between the narrowly materialistic, the economic function, which is very real and important, and the wider mission, which we shouldn't forget. I think my own department and my own job, in a way, explains how these things have been reconciled. I don't know whether people from overseas are familiar with the British ministerial structure, but my own department is effectively a Ministry of Economics. That's one of our primary functions. We look after industry policy and regulation, matters related to long-term growth of the economy, but we're also the Ministry for Universities. And these two things were deliberately brought together under the same roof because of the understanding that long-term economic growth were very much tied up with the future of universities, higher and indeed further education. So that this connection in the UK has been institutionalized, and in a way I'm the walking embodiment of that change. But let me just to sort of address the basic question, which is, how is it that the university sector does contribute to economic growth? I think several very specific points. I mean, first of all, there is sort of basic economic theory which explains how and why this happens, based around the ideas of human capital. Those of you who are familiar with economics will know people like Romer at Harvard, who have done a lot of work cross-sectional between countries and comparing countries over time, which shows that certainly at the more developed end of countries, human capital, and that was embodying education, is probably the most important driver of economic growth. In economies at the beginning of development, what really matters is investment, fixed investment, capital formation, and the growth of population, or the growth of the working population. But as economies become more developed, it's human capital that is key. Now, that, of course, isn't simply a crude issue about the number of graduates. It's certainly relevant and it's correlated. But of course, it isn't just higher education universities, it's also further education and apprenticeships, and graduates vary considerably in their ability to contribute to economic performance. But nonetheless, there is a very clear link, and it's an important component in the policy debate. The second way in which universities contribute to economic growth is through innovation, and this happens directly. We've seen, you know, the whole Silicon Valley phenomenon based at least in part on the outgrowth from Caltech and universities in California. Comparable institutions here, the cluster of innovative companies around Cambridge is a good example in the UK, or on a different model, the Fraunhofer's in Germany, which are based essentially on a partnership between universities and business. So innovation directly spins out of certainly the scientific work of or applied science work of universities. But I think secondly and more fundamentally, because this isn't just about science, it is about ways of thinking, about a critical approach to evidence, scientific method in the widest sense, and societies that don't have that find it very difficult to sustain innovation and growth in the longer term. And a third factor, I would say, is local growth. I think one of the things that really interests us here in the UK is the enormous difference that universities make to their local economy. And this happens in different ways. Some of our big cities that were economically struggling, I think Manchester would be a good example, have been totally transformed by the complex of universities, which are at their heart. We have some provincial cities which have had new universities. I think Teesside would be an example, perhaps Plymouth, perhaps Wolverhampton, which have acted as a hub for economic activity, for local businesses, really quite transformative in their impact. So that growth works in these different ways, but cumulatively, the effect is very, very considerable. Now, let me sort of look at this in a sort of future way. I'm just describing the story in narrow economic terms and predominantly from the vantage point of one country, which is my own. But if we look at this globally, I mean, all the projections suggest that the university sector is going to be massively expanded in years ahead. I mean, a country like India is talking about 40 million new graduates in the next 10 years. I mean, you know, question of what is a graduate and different levels of learning, but nonetheless, staggering numbers coming out of the big emerging markets like India and China and Brazil, on top of already extremely large numbers. If you look at this in terms of economic value added, we're talking about an industry, I know it's questionable use of language, but an industry which in many ways is already the second largest industry in the world after healthcare. We're talking about the valuation of somewhere between $4.5 to $5 trillion going through the education sector and growing very, very rapidly, presenting both opportunities and challenges. And what are some of those challenges? Well, the first is obviously affordability. Almost every country is trying to expand its higher education sector rapidly, bring in more students, also improve quality, who pays for it? And we've faced in many countries, including ours, the issue of how do you pay? We've been through in the UK some pretty politically painful process of reform, effectively funding university quality and expansion as a result of effectively taxing the future earnings of graduates. Other countries have been forced to confront this in different ways, but there is an issue of affordability. There is a question of how this expansion reflects changing demand. We have an enormous gap in the UK between the actual and prospective demand, for example, for engineers, which is absolutely acute, and on the other hand, the fact that in some occupations we're building up a substantial stock of graduate unemployment. And the mismatch between demand and supply is often quite extreme. The problem of graduate engineers is one that greatly preoccupies me, particularly where women are concerned. We have this unusual and worrying fact that I think in British state schools, in half of all British state schools, there's not a single girl studying physics, which means they can't do engineering. And so you've got half the population which is totally unprepared for the area for which there is potentially the greatest demand. So when we talk about expansion, we're not just talking about expansion in aggregate, but expansion in a world of rapidly changing skill sets. And then the other challenge is what economists, the distinction the economists between stock and flows, that of course growth is about the current flow of graduates passing through institutions, but we also have a stock of people who graduated up to 50 years ago
and whose skills are rapidly becoming obsolete and happenstly have to retrain, which raises issues about lifelong learning, not just about current university experiences. So that there is the sort of underlying point I think I'm trying to make here is that there is rapid growth, particularly in the big emerging markets, but it's not simple. We're dealing with rapidly changing demand, and we're dealing with very acute issues of affordability. Let me just then address the issue about how I approach these questions in the UK. You know, what is the overall approach to the university sector in a world which is becoming more integrated, which is more competitive, where we start from a considerable advantage of a recognition of very high standards. Certainly those league tables can be extremely misleading, just as they are for schools, but it is a source of some pride, I think, in the UK that we have 3 out of 10 universities in the top 10 ranking and something of the order of 30 in the top 200. Now, you can measure these things in different ways, and there are plenty outside of those league tables that have a marvellously impressive performance in terms of value added. But nonetheless, these metrics are used, and it is something that we take some pride in. So how is it that we maintain that standing and indeed improve it? I think the first is a recognition that we are operating in a much more competitive environment, both domestically and internationally. Domestically, we, in the course of pursuing the reforms that we have had to in terms of fees, have also recognised that there is going to be more competition in the university sector for pupils. We have tried, and it's a complex and difficult process, and it's a bit like sort of perestroika in the Soviet Union, trying to demolish a very, very stratified, controlled, rather Stalinist system of university place administration by government with something that is more open and more competitive, and indeed in which universities compete for pupils and in which potential students behave increasingly like consumers who make informed choices. And we're trying to introduce those kind of approaches in the course of introducing very difficult economic changes. Secondly, we do recognise that this is an open international system. Overseas students present an extremely positive and important contribution to our university sector. I mean, this is in crude terms, of course, this brings in income, but it brings in much more than that in terms of improving the university experience, and something that we very much welcome. It's good for the country and it's good for the university sector. And currently we have something of the order of 13% of the higher education student market, if we can call it that internationally, second to the United States. And there are about 435,000 overseas students here. I've just come back from Brazil promoting the Science Without Frontiers student exchange, and I and my colleagues intend to do much more of that. One of the problems we have, and those in the university sector in the UK will be painfully familiar with that, stems from a rather strange statistical anomaly that the United Nations, in its wisdom, has classified overseas students as immigrants. Of course, they're not, but the definition of an immigrant is somebody who stays in a country for more than 12 months. So they have been counted in the number of immigrants coming into the UK and have therefore been caught up in this very highly emotive debate around immigration, which we have, and not just the UK. All the evidence we have, and there'll be some very good survey work done at Oxford University, suggests that the British public don't see overseas students as immigrants. They see them in a quite different way, in a much more positive way. But nonetheless, they have got caught up in this very torrid and emotional argument about the numbers of immigrants. So as a consequence, when university overseas students increase their numbers in the UK, this is easily translated into a flood of immigrants. And when last week the number declines, this is a great triumph for immigration control, which is quite absurd and unfortunately is seriously distorting the debate on sensible university policy and indeed sensible immigration policy. But I just want to make it absolutely clear that, as far as the government's concerned, we have no cap on the number of overseas students. We don't propose to introduce one. As members of the government go around the world trying to increase the numbers, of course, legitimate overseas students, there has been a problem, a fairly minor problem, but nonetheless a real problem of bogus institutions, particularly doing English language teaching. But nonetheless, our broad approach to this is a positive and outward-looking one. Now, the overseas experience isn't simply confined to overseas students. British universities teach more overseas students overseas than they do in the UK. There's about 570,000 overseas students are taught in overseas campuses, actually rather more than they're taught here. And something of the order of 75% of British higher education institutions have international overseas campus work. Perhaps just to conclude this section with a slightly sort of wider point, such is the importance of the overseas experience to British university sector, and indeed the FE colleges too, that we increasingly see this as a major export industry. One of the things I'm trying to introduce with my colleagues in the UK government is the concept of an industrial strategy, trying to think ahead long term and trying to think in terms of partnership between government and business. And a key part of the industrial strategy is trying to work with the education sector to build it up as an important British export industry, which of course it is, and we're working in partnership indeed with people in this room to help realise that objective. Let me just say finally that while all of this debate continues, we're operating in an environment of very, very rapid technological change, which is sweeping away many of the assumptions on which this discussion is based. Over the last decade, we've had 870% growth in internet traffic, of course, much of that related to the exchange of knowledge. There's roughly a 23% growth annually in e-learning. You're all now familiar with the MOOCs, the massive online open teaching methods. The Open University in the UK is developing the so-called Future Learn concept, involving 21 universities, and this is increasingly becoming an important component of the way that higher education is delivered. But I'll just finish with this point. This is ultimately an enabler. You know, technology is not important in itself. It's important because it facilitates other things. And we're ultimately dealing here with a people business. And it's the quality of people, whether they're teaching and students, that really matters. And the ability and the willingness of government to put resources behind them alongside individuals and business. And that's my job, and I'm delighted to respond to any questions you have. Thank you.